Okay. Just as far as yesterday, is there any questions from stuff that we did yesterday before we, because we sort of just got sidetracked. Anyone have any other questions about the elections or stuff like that? I don't think I explained, so how does a party actually, you know, get enough? So you need to have at least 61 seats. I told you that now the major parties will roughly get in the low 30s, so they'll need to form a coalition. And the coalition, they'll get, you know, other smaller parties to join with them, and that's what I said, all the politicking comes in. You want me, I demand this, I demand this, I demand this. And then you have natural coalition parties, you know, certain people who naturally go with the, let's say, more left wing, and those who naturally go with the more right wing. But it's not always true. You've had parties, certainly religious parties, who over the times just said, okay, I'll go wherever you give money to my constituents. And that's why, you know, I have major problems with this, but, you know, in the past, you had both Aguda and Shas saying, okay, you know, I'll vote in favor of Oslo, or I'll vote in favor of kicking out the Jews from Gush Katif as long as money keeps coming into my yeshivas and stuff like that. So I feel that, you know, that's problematic. Yeah.
Why did Ravai Yosef start the party?
Why
did he start a party? Ah,
Shas.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll get to it later on.
But
at the
doesn't it say that it should stay away from politics in the Pekarabot?
It's not a Rabbanut. Yeah, it's not the Rabbanut. What he did, I mean, at the end of the year, I give a Hall of Famer shir, and I talk about Ravadia, and I come into Rav Tzadok shir, and I do it for Rav Tzadok shir. So that's where you are, right?
Yeah.
So I'll do it at the end of the year. But I'll say now, when Ravadia got involved in politics, at the time, I was so disappointed. I thought, this is going to sully his name. Ravadi would have just gone down as greatest posik of the generation, and now he's going to get in politics, and there's going to be all sorts of bad-mouthing, and what a mistake. This is my feeling. And now, many years later, I feel that what he did was great for him. I mean, I'm not saying I agree with it, but so many Sfardim now are from and learning because of things that he did.
Because of him starting the party?
Yeah. When he started this party, what he did was so interesting. He got all this money for his organization. So he got his El Ma'ayan school system. So the average Sephardi family sent their kids to public school and then had to find some after-school daycare thing because everyone had to work, husbands and wives, till today in Israel can't really support a family with just one salary, you need both working. So you went off to a public school and then they had to pay for like some sort of chug while the parents were working. Comes along Rav Avadia and he says, okay, come to my school system and we'll have longer days and give out a free hot lunch. So you're Sephardi, which means you're traditional. You're not anti-Torah. So what's wrong with my kid learning a little Torah? He's going to get, with his free tuition, also a hot lunch, saves me money. Longer hours, I don't have to pay for chug. So it was in, I'm a Sephardi family, you know, whatever I'm doing, I'm a mechanic, I'm driving a cab, whatever, it's in my best interest for my son to do this. I'm not opposed to him being more learned. And because of that, so many people became, you know, Shomer Mitzvot much more than they were before, a generation later. I said to Rabina, you could tell the difference, you know, what happened. When I first moved to this country, you walked into any garage and you'd see, like, behind me, you got to go pay, you'd see, like, some calendar with, like, you know, I don't know, girl in a bikini, you know, on the calendar. And now you walk in, you see a picture of Vadi on the Baba Sali. You know, it's like, it's different. Like, people have changed. And I think Ravadia is primarily responsible for that, even though he himself, I think, did like 8 minutes of politics a day while I was filling. People came, all politicians, asked him those questions, and he went back to learning. But he was making big decisions for people. And there was a sea change in the Sephardi community in Israel. So, you know, I might have complaints that how come they don't go in the army, or how come they were willing to sell out with Oslo and stuff like that. Okay, my own personal, you know, view on the state of Israel and the army. But as far as religiously, there's no doubt that the Shas party and getting all the money for the schools changed, you know, the Sephardi community in Israel. Okay, and once again, since it was all about that, he would sell himself to the highest bidder. He would say, I'll go with the right-wing party, I'll go with the left-wing party, because all I'm interested in is getting money for my school systems. So Shas sat in all different governments. Right? Very often, they were the kingmaker. The way Avigdor Lieberman is now, they were the kingmaker, saying, you give me this ministry, this idea, I'm in charge, I'm pushing money to the programs that I think are important. And also they make all these claims, don't draft yeshiva students, all these different things. Okay, so now we'll vote however else you want. So I might view that in certain areas selling out, but they'll view it as, what are you talking about? We're playing the game and getting exactly what we want. Right, you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, fine. That's the elections. Hopefully, this third elections will be the last of the elections. Who knows? You know, so what do people do now? Now they badmouth Avigdor Lieberman, saying a vote for Lieberman is voting for a fourth election. Because just like the first two elections, he decided not to go with either party unless they came together and they didn't come together and cause a third election. They said, don't vote for Lieberman, trying to weaken his strength. If he has not as many seats, now he's had between 8 and 10 seats. He has only 2-3 seats, so then we don't need him. So that's what people are doing. He obviously is saying the opposite. And you know, everyone just is slinging mud at the people that they view as the biggest rivals to try to get as many seats as they can. And right after they kiss and make up and try to come together and, you know, see if they can form a party. Whether it will work, I don't know. I'm very disappointed in the entire system. I think that we should have seen by now that there's a major flaw and this should be fixed.
Can you change it now, though?
Well, the problem is it's hard to change it when the politicians are there. But let's say, for example, you could say there is no party unless you would have at least, I don't know, make up 10 seats, 15 seats. And then instead of having so many little parties, you would have major blocks. You'd have, let's say, I don't know, like Likud and Blue and White. You'd have an entire religious party together, maybe religious and right-wing together, because there's a fear, what happens if I need 15 seats? And the religious parties, right now, Agud and Shas together, and they run separately, even though they agree on almost everything, right? They run separately. They roughly got 15. Let's say you needed 15. Let's say you needed 20. So they're not going to run separately. If it's 15, they might not even run separately. Because what a shame if they get 14 seats and then all their seats are wasted, they get nothing. So maybe then you form like some bigger block, right-wing and religious, because for the most part, the religious, their feeling is right-wing. Eretz Yisrael HaShlema. And you'd have, I don't know, then you have the far left altogether. You have four parties. It'd be easier to do something.
Far right and the religious people probably don't agree about a lot of things.
Okay, but I'm saying like, but as long as you keep upping the bar, people have to learn how to get together. Even in the Likud or in the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, you have people that are more extreme and less extreme, more moderate. Yep, but people say, okay, but by and large, we're Republican, or by and large, we're Democrats, right? You have Democrats that are embarrassed of, you know, one side of the Democratic aisle is embarrassed of the other side of the Democratic aisle. But for the most part, they're Democrats. So here as well, you could sit there and say, for the most, we agree, what we agree on is more important than that divides us. Let's form these major coalitions. And then instead of having what we're going to have now, like 10 to 12 parties, have, I don't know, 3-4 parties and you know, let the, I think that might help. I don't know.
But they can't institute this new system.
So the problem with introducing it is, if I'm in a party that now has 5 seats, I'm not going to vote for upping it to 15 seats because I stand to not get into the next Knesset. Right? That's the problem, that everyone is worried about their job. So, like, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you, but certainly the system's not working if this is our third election in less than a year. You know, the joke that one of the Kol guys told me when this was called, they said, oh, the Rosh Yeshiva are trying to move this third election up. I said, why? He goes, so the fourth one will be for Elsman. You know, like how many times are we going to, you know, something dysfunctional here if every few months we have another elections? It means that there's no budget that's being voted upon. You know,
nothing's
happening. Right now, obviously, people are preparing for a war and stuff like that, but there's no money going into anything. I mean, I don't know. So, that's a problem. There's no new initiatives.
What happened with Otsma, like they got kicked out or something?
They got, at first, the Bayit Yehudi, whatever, I know what it's called, they made a deal with them.
Yes.
The person who did it, without asking any of the people that's with him, so they were a little upset.
Well, like, to be together?
Well, the person who was in charge, who was brought in, who was a novice, same thing was about Benny Gantz. He's a novice to politics. This guy, Rav Rafi Peretz, yeah, Rabin is friendly with. Okay? He went to Yeshivat Nativ Meir. He's a student of Rabina's father. He had been the chief rabbi of the army. And he's been in this building meeting with Rabina. He was brought in to be the head of the Bayit Yehudi party. And he decided to make an agreement with Otzma Yehudi. Without asking any of his, like, his number two man, number three man, all the people in his party, they were not happy with him just making this decision. And then, at the end, Rav Chaim Drukman said, according to all the polls, it looks like you guys are not going to pass, and you should dump Otzma Yehudi and go with Yamina, like the new right or whatever. Basically, the people that ran last
week.
So they dumped him because the other right-wing party said, we don't want to be with someone who idealizes Baruch Goldstein, who killed, you know, 29 Arabs in the mosque, in the Mount of Machpelah. So, when push came to shove, he broke his agreement, which is, you know, dirty politics. So, he came up looking the worst, you know, of Rafi Peretz.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if he is the leader of the Bayit Yehudi party the next time there's elections. Hopefully that'll be in 4 years, not in 4 months. And who knows? Anyway, here we go. We were talking about the early years, and we spoke about the German reparations, and we spoke about Unit 101. Now I want to talk about some symbolic things that were done early in the beginning of the early years that had major...
Yeah.
Okay. That had major implications for the future. First of all, one of the first laws that the Knesset passed was the Law of Return. What is the Law of Return?
Any Jew can come.
Any Jew can come to Eretz Yisrael. Automatic citizenship. Okay? Now, Israel has the right to refuse a particular Jew if they feel he is a threat to society. Let's say some guy, there was one Jewish mobster that wanted to run away from America, you know, and come to Israel, and Israel refused him, you know, to come into the country. But any Jew. Now, who is a Jew? That's a big question. So how did the Knesset word it? Basically, they said anyone Hitler would have killed, we will let in. So this whole idea was sort of like a reaction to Hitler. Hitler was killing these Jews. The British were not letting anyone in.
He would have killed any Jew, though.
What?
Hitler would have killed any Jew.
Correct. Who did he, however, classify as a Jew? Anyone who had a Jewish grandparent. Now, halachically, that's not necessarily a Jew. Okay? When Rabbi Leibowitz was giving a shiur this morning, I said right away to Jacob Ibrahami, who was sitting next to me, I said, oh, I'll tell the case, the problem is this guy's a Kohen. Why does exactly happen to me in the army? Guy came over to me, when my big 2.5 weeks in the army, one of the Russians said to me, why is it that according to the Torah, you can have 3 out of 4 Jewish grandparents and your kid's not Jewish? So I didn't feel this guy with so much passion was asking a theoretical question. So I said, do you know many people like that? He goes, yeah, my son. Right? That's what I figured. said, both my parents are Jewish, my wife's father is Jewish, I come to this country, they tell me he's not Jewish. So then I said, why doesn't your wife and son convert? So he said, well, I'm a Kohen. So what's the problem?
He converts,
he can't stay married to his wife. A Kohen can't marry a Gior. So Bais is not going to convert a woman who is not going to keep mitzvot. And if she's saying straight out, I'm going to stay married to my Kohen husband, they won't do the conversion. And she wasn't going to leave her husband. And he didn't want her to leave. So in the end, I said to him, look, I don't know what to say about your wife, but when your kid gets older, he can go to Bais Din and try to convert on his own. So that's why I had this opinion, this thought here. But since Hitler said that, the law of return said anyone who's a Jewish grandparent can come back. So in the early 90s, when the Iron Curtain fell, so you had about 1 million Russians that came to Israel based on the law of return. Many, I'm talking about not tens of thousands, but hundreds of thousands, not Jewish. Because as long as you had a Jewish grandparent, you were considered, as far as the law of return, a Jew, and you can come and you get all whatever benefits there are to being Jewish. Now, in Russia, the economic situation was terrible. So coming to Israel was a huge step up. And you would leave. You would leave, and it was great. You got this whole basket of benefits. So you read about this in Jewish literacy?
Yeah.
Right?
About the Russian, what do you call it?
Refuseniks.
There was bad things happening to them. They were getting killed by...
Right.
The Jewish Russians?
Yeah.
The grumps.
So that was earlier. But then also, later on, you have these refuseniks of Russian that left. So they finally, the Iron Curtain falls, Jews are allowed out, and you had hundreds of thousands of Jews. Now, the cool thing is that the majority of people that came were Jewish. And that's an amazing thing. So many people came. And it's no different. If you read Ezra and Nehemiah, Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah, both of them talk about all of the intermarriage. There are lots and lots of non-Jews that were living here, and how do they deal with it? Ezra had one way, Nehemiah had a different way. So it's really no different in Jewish history. We had a repeat, and there were non-Jews, and what do we do with the non-Jews? So one of the cool things that I didn't know, I just didn't realize this, the army helps not just Russians, but there's lots of non-Jews in the Israeli army. Okay, you could have some birthright person. Okay, another cool fact. The majority of singles that make aliyah on Nefesh B'Nefesh are irreligious Jews. Crazy thing. The majority of couples, families that make aliyah from America, Nefesh B'Nefesh, are from Jews. It's mitzvah to make aliyah. They come from, the five towns and Teaneck and West Hempstead and they're making aliyah. But the singles, it's Nefesh B'Nefesh because of birthright. People came on birthright, fell in love with the country, and said, this is where I want to live. A bunch of them aren't Jewish. They went on birthright because the last name is Markowitz or Cohen or Schwartz. But their mothers, maiden names, are whatever.
Birthright doesn't mean you don't need your mom to be Jewish on birthright?
No.
You have to be Jewish? Technically Jewish?
It's run by, birthright is started by really Reformed Jews, so they consider them Jewish. Right?
They're probably not Jewish themselves.
Yeah. So you have these people, and some of them aren't Jewish. So you can have people coming, and they're serving the Israeli army, they're fluent in Hebrew, but either Russians or from other countries or like Americans that went to some of the colleges that you might be going to.
Yeah, I met a guy, he was from Philadelphia, he wasn't Jewish, and he went on a polo trip to Israel, and he just fell in love with the country, and now he made aliyah in Israel, he's in the army.
Right. So the army has this cool thing where this is what they do. They take all of these soldiers and you can go for 6 weeks and you take classes about Israel and about Judaism.
Ulpan?
I thought Ulpan. They already learned Hebrew. They had to do Ulpan before they go in the army because I can't go in the army if I'm giving orders and you don't understand what I'm saying. You can jeopardize everyone in the army. Right, so you clearly have to speak Hebrew. That's separate. And the army also does that. They have ulpans. Some of the guys from our yeshiva, before they go into the army, they're sent first to this place where they have to learn Hebrew. But I'm talking about people already in the army, and they pull you out. Now, if you're very happy to do this. If you're in the middle of a 3-year service, and now it's the middle of the winter, and you have a choice of lying in a ditch in the winter when it's raining upon you, and lying in ambush, or, oh, I can do a 6-week thing where I sleep in a comfortable bed and I just sit in a classroom. All right, I'm down, you know? So these people go, and they learn about Israel, learn about Judaism, and then after that 6-week thing, for those who are more interested in becoming Jewish, you can sign up for more, and then there's more in-depth classes. My daughter-in-law, that was her army service. She was involved in this Gairus part of the army. It was out of Kfar Etzion, which is near where I live in Gush Etzion. And a lot of people, they convert. And the army helps them. They have to go to the Beis Din. And, you know, Beis Din will decide if they're serious or not, if they're sincere or not. And they have to spend Shabbos at someone's house. They have to see what Shabbos is like. They see what a Jewish family's like. There's all sorts of stuff that go on. It's a very cool thing that the army does this to help people become Jewish. Because what happens is, if you were serving in the army for 3 years, shoulder to shoulder with this guy, he speaks fluent Hebrew, just like you. You assume he's Jewish. Then what happens? You set him up with your sister or your cousin. And it turns out, guess what? He's not Jewish. So it's in Israel's best interest, if they would be serious, to convert them. Because people already think they're Jewish.
Because they speak Hebrew.
Right. Right. I had it once. One of my sons called me up from the army to ask me some halakha question that somebody was going on. I said, Ellie, is he Jewish? He goes, oh, right, he's not even Jewish. Right? So,
yeah.
So like, it depends on, you know. So the army has this thing, which is a cool thing. Anyway, so law of return, Ben-Gurion felt this was our Bill of Rights, guaranteed to all Jews in the diaspora by the State of Israel, an expression of the supreme mission of the state. As I said, it was basically because Jews were not allowed in by the British. We will allow them to come in. Automatic citizenship. Fantastic. Now, there were a bunch of very cool operations, right, to bring Jews from certain countries to Israel at this time. One of them was called Mivtza Ezra v'Nechemia. Operation Ezra v'Nechemia. This took the Jews from Bavel. Which country is modern?
Iraq.
So Jews have been living in Iraq for 2,700 years. And the Israeli government goes to the Iraqi government asking, you know, will you allow permission for these Iraqi Jews to leave? And the Iraqi authorities give permission. Okay? And at first, some wealthy Jews, now Iraqis, however, say, you have to leave all your property. They limit how much money you can take with you. And some people did it. They assumed that all in all, about 8,000 Jews would leave Iraq. But in the first month, there were 50,000 Jews there, ready to leave. By the end of 2 months, there were 90,000 Jews. Iraq was going nuts because these were Jews that held all sorts of important positions. They felt that the economy was going to fall apart. So they started limiting it, but in the end, 130,000 Jews left Bavel. 130,000 Jews.
What year was
leaving? 1952. That's when it ended. They started earlier. By 1952, it ended. Leaving only about 6,000 Jews in Iraq. All right? So when they thought only 8,000 would go, only 6,000 stayed. All right?
That's crazy.
Now the reason why the Jews wanted to get out of the Reddit because of all these pogroms that were breaking out, right?
So they're oppressed in then?
What?
They're oppressed in Iraq?
Well, they had lived in Iraq for 2,700 years and things were good, but the Mufti of Yerushalayim that we'd spoken about in earlier classes, he inspired these pro-Nazis to start attacking Jews in Iraq, and about 180 Jews were killed with complicity of the Iraqi police and another 1,000 wounded. So when they had the opportunity to leave, Jews saw the writing on the walls that it's not safe for us here anymore. It doesn't matter how many centuries we lived here. and they just left. Yeah. Jews left Syria for the same reasons. Pogroms were breaking out there. Another place, 2,500 years, 2,700 years. Jews have been living in Syria. And Jews leave.
What happened to the Persian Jews?
Persians don't leave till much later. Because they didn't have any problems till later.
They had the same thing, the pogroms?
No. No. It was like a westernized, the Shah was okay, and Israel had dealings with them. Only when Ayatollah Khomeini takes over in 1979. Yes.
It's not really.
Rob, do you think that all these programs happened in all these other countries to get like Moshiach to come and all that, for like all the Jews to eventually come to Israel?
Look,
like, what do you think?
What you're saying is interesting. I'm telling you right now the politics, right? The politics, it's happened because the Mufti got them excited. It was during World War II, he's pro Nazi, or right after Israel formed. And the Arab states were defeated in battle. They took it out on the Jews in their country, so more people fled. That's the politics. Why Kadosh Baruch Hu let it happen? That's a whole separate issue. And I don't know. Okay? I don't profess to be a Navi to say I know. But what you're asking is a good question. Right? That's what Navim come along to do. They come along to write the editorials and to say why they think things happen. Right? I'm telling you what happened. But you could argue, you know, why something happened. I don't know. But your question's good.
I was thinking about it because, the theory that everything that happened, not theory, the fact that everything happens, like, revolving around the Jews, right?
Okay.
So, if that's true, do you think the coronavirus is, like...
I don't know.
Is offensive?
You're asking me a question that I can't answer. I don't know.
I was in Peter's class yesterday, and he said, yeah, 100% it is.
Okay, so then there you have it. You had another operation called Operation Magic Carpet.
I know.
Where's it from? Yemen. Okay, the Jews from Yemen, Tayman. Also, it started here. There's a pogrom, and 82 Jews were killed in Aden. What?
The Yemenite Jews, and they made them
narrow. Oh, that's what I'm getting. So now, 50,000 Yemenite Jews come to Eretz Yisrael. Now, this also took a while. You had 380 flights that were taking these Jews. It wasn't announced till months afterwards, you know, that this operation was pulled off. In the end, in just 1949, the first year, 250,000 Jews arrived in Israel. Now, calculations were made that year that showed that it was $3,000 needed for each immigrant. Okay? So, do the math. 250,000 Jews. So what do we have?
75 million.
Okay. The entire budget for Israel that year was 700 million. And that's why it was just very difficult. And the line that Rabina says all the time began already in 1949. It was said already then, Israel loves Aliyah, but they hate Olam. It was they hate the actual immigrants. It's very exciting to have people moving in. But when it comes down to it, there's no jobs, there's no food, there's crowding, and when you get to what Yisrael said, you don't look like me, you don't act like me, your culture is totally different. Okay? So, it becomes very problematic. Now, especially, Al.
What happened with Tamania children in Kenya?
That's what I'm going to get to. Now, there are lots of hardships coming in. They were put in tents. You had families, whole families, that were thrown in the same type of tent that you guys stayed in last week. We went to Eilat. Some big tent, no partitions, and you put 20 families, women, children, men, women, other families, everyone sharing the same tent. They stayed in like these metal tin things that were boiling hot in the summer. It was extremely difficult. You had hundreds of people sharing showers. In one case, 56 people shared one toilet.
They can't even talk to each
other. And, right, they didn't necessarily even speak the same language. Okay? Some of you might have seen this. There's a comedy that was made about this time period, and Frank Kishon wrote Salach Shabbati. Anyone ever see this? I've mentioned this in the past. Some guys said, oh, I saw it in camp. They showed it on a rainy day. Salach Shabbati was sort of like a, what was the name of one immigrant. He was played by Chaim Tupal. Later on, became Fiddler on the Roof in the movie. But Chaim Tupal played Salach Shabbati, which they said was a takeoff on Slicha Shabbati. Sorry that I came. Right? Because it was difficult. Because I came and I made it harder. And it was very, very difficult. Also, people came from all these different places, so they were humiliated. There was medical examinations, inoculations, fumigated with DDT. They thought they were carrying infections. It was humiliating to people. Plus, with all of these people who in their previous life, I just said to you, these wealthy people from Iraq came. They had businesses. They were extremely intelligent people who ran businesses, and now they have nothing to do. So they were sitting around playing backgammon all day. And they lost their dignity. Right? Because they got to find jobs. And it wasn't happening because the country was so busy just trying to feed them and find a place that they couldn't create jobs yet. So it was very, very difficult. And then, who are these people? These are Sephardim. They all came in at this time. Ashkenazim come in earlier. So when the Ashkenazim come in, oh, very good timing. All of these, like, Arabs fled in 48 or right before. So Ashkenazim moved right into their homes. Now you have Sephardim coming in. Do they have homes? No. They're throwing a whole bunch of them into a tent together, into a tin house. So you have all these demonstrations that we want to be treat us like the Ashkenazim. What's that all about? Then, as I said, you have the cultural problem. So what's the country trying to do? I can't deal with so many different cultures. Let's just try to make, or be as fond of, a melting pot. What's a melting pot? A melting pot is, I take all the different colors, let's say, I throw it and mix it all together in a cauldron, and it's all the same color. Ugly looking color, you know? Instead of having a beautiful yellow and a beautiful orange and a beautiful pink, it's just one greenish, ugly looking mud color. And that's what Israel wanted. You should all accept what we called Israeli culture. Israeli, because we've been here all of, I know, 30 years more than you, you know? But that's what they wanted now. You have people coming from Yemen, from people with payas. And now they're thrown into some kibbutz or whatever, or some place. Hey, right away, you shouldn't look different. Cut off the payas. You don't need these tefillin. Now, was the government doing it to wipe out religion? I don't think so. Okay? I think they were doing it just to make everyone one. But it certainly was anti-religious. And certainly, you know, one could look back at it and say, a terrible thing that the government did, trying to take away our religion. So there's a lot of animosity towards what was going on here. Now again, I believe that they were trying to cope the best that they could. And I don't think it was in an overt way of let's get rid of religion. But it certainly had that effect. Right? And you had these people that for 2,500 years keeping tradition, and all of a sudden now, you know, get rid of it. We don't do that anymore. And that was very problematic. Okay. Religion versus politics was an issue from the beginning. I mentioned to you that Ben-Gurion made a compromise with the Chazon Ish about draft dodging. Alex knew right away it was 400 at the time. There's a lot of other, I guess, symbolic religious things that were done by the state. First is Holocaust. Okay, right away, Israel took it upon itself that we are going to hunt down Nazis. Most famous, who do they hunt down? Adolf Eichmann. We'll talk about the whole thing later. There's also a new Netflix thing that came out. There used to be an old one.
Really?
Yeah. It wasn't any better than the old one. They made Yad Vashem in 1953. Okay? It's the first Holocaust museum. They made in 1959. There should be Yom HaShoah. Right? So Israel felt that this is where the survivors, you know, came, and this is where those who perished would have come if they had the opportunity. Just wasn't allowed. So Israel took it upon himself. We're representing the Jewish people. In the same fashion, we spoke about lots of Jews who fought in World War II came. And I said to you, Mickey Marcus, He became the first general. There's an American that came, and he was the first general, the first head of the Air Force, a guy named Paul Shulman, right? Also, he was from the Navy. He came over. These were all American soldiers or British soldiers that came over and threw their lot with, you know, this was the making of Jewish history. They wanted to be part of Jewish history. And then you had symbolic things. The Israeli flag. This goes back to the Zionist conference. The Star of David had been a Jewish symbol for centuries. Let me go back to David HaMelech, but it's been for centuries. The blue and white is like the talus with the tchelet. The Israeli emblem is the menorah, sort of like the antithesis to Titus's arch, you know, where they carried away the menorah and destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. So that menorah now is, you know, the symbol of the Israeli government. The name of the state, you know, Israel goes back to the Torah. Shabbos is an official day off. Yontem is an official day off. And Ben-Gurion was himself, he loved learning Tanakh. He's the one who was behind that there should be Jewish learning in the public schools. So in the Israeli public schools, they had to teach about Shabbos and Yontif. You had to teach about the Siddur and the Machzor, what the Torah is, what Torah reading is, Tefillin, Mezuzah, all sorts of stuff. And this after was watered down because the left didn't like what he originally said, so he watered it down. He wanted more. Now, Ben-Gurion once called a press conference, and everyone came together because he gave a chiddush that he thought of, something he thought about when he was learning Tanakh. He was very excited about the chiddush that he called a press conference. The reporters were not so happy. But he did this thing. Ben-Gurion felt you have to know Tanakh. And they started until today. He wasn't religious.
Why did he?
Because he felt you have to attach yourself to your roots. Okay? Till today, on Yom HaAtzmaut, one of the main events is the Bible quiz, the Chidon Tanakh. Anyone know anyone that ever participated in the Chidon Tanakh? Okay, you have a Chidon Tanakh. So the people that win it in America, they come and they take part. It's almost always an Israeli that wins it. They know Tanakh a lot better. Give me a second here. The Chidon Tanakh, every Yom HaAtzmaut, cool thing that happened. My son was in Susia, and once this kid had a great memory. He challenged all the kids. I bet you I can know everyone in the whole school's phone number, cell phone number. So everyone was in on it. Everyone like put money in. And they come the next day. One day, and this rabbi's watching. They're throwing out numbers. He's saying, oh, that's Ariel's. Oh, you know, that's Frilly's. And he's saying like a name, saying the phone number. This rabbi goes, look, you had a great memory. When you studied the Chidon Tanakh? It was like 4 months ago. He goes, okay. And this guy had a great memory. He won it in Israel. He ended up going into the playoffs and losing in overtime to this guy. But like all these other guys are not, they're the nerdy, nerdy guys. You know, they button the top button. They have little pocket protectors. And this guy's in jeans and t-shirts. Yeah, I was like this going, it's right there. He's like, yeah. He threw it out. He knew it. It's amazing. Like, it's so cool that this rabbi did this. But I want to end with one very cool thing.
It's like a whole event.
Yeah, it's an event. It's a big deal. It's on TV. The prime minister's there. He asks questions. They have all these questions. The whole committee. A guy from my community is one of the people who makes up the questions. Now, the 1950s, Secretary of State Dulles Airport is named after him, if those have ever been to Washington, D.C., said to Ben-Gurion, who's visiting the United States, how can you head a country called Israel? Who do you represent? You got Polish people, Russians, Yemenites, Moroccans. Right? Basically, there is no Jewish nation. You're just a hodgepodge of displaced people. So listen to this amazing line of Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion responded, go out to the street and ask 10 school children the following questions. About 300 years ago, the original settlers came on the Mayflower to start what would be the greatest democracy in the world. Here are the four questions I want you to ask. Who is the captain of the ship? Question number two, how long was the journey? Question number three, what did they eat during the journey? Question number four, what was the condition of the sea? So now go find 10 Jews from any country in the world and ask them not 300 years ago, but 3,300 years ago when they left Egypt for Israel. Who was their leader? One. How long was their journey? Two. What did they eat during the journey? Three. What happened to the Red Sea when they confronted it? Rest my case. Okay. Stop there.